continue their efforts to make sure that Governor Abbott stops this practice, that Operation Lone Star is ended, and that we can no longer have the separation of families on our watch. It's unconscionable, and it goes against all of our values.
And Marissa, can you explain further? They're arresting the men on trespassing charges?
Yes, the trespassing charges is the tool that the governor is using with Operation Lone Star to be able to put the men. That's one of the very few access points that they have as a way of legally operating through the Department of Public Safety. And so this mechanism results in separation of families. And those families are actually supposed to be all presented together to Border Patrol officials and not have the separation occur. And so there's certainly some kind of breakdown between Border Patrol and DPS in what's actually happening at the southern border. This has caused the communities in Eagle Pass to respond in different ways. There's been reporting recently about different people in the community, landowners and others, having real issue with these practices. And the city council actually had privatized a park, and now that's become public again because there wasn't a real understanding of the great lengths that the Abbott government would go to make sure that there was harm placed on migrants.
So I want to go to this issue of the razor wire. You're in El Paso, and I want to ask you about the response in the border city of Eagle Pass, Texas, where residents gathered Monday night along the Rio Grande to commemorate asylum seekers who've drowned in the river. This is Jesse Fuentes, who is pursuing a lawsuit against Texas over new river barriers covered in razor wire they installed and their environmental impact. He spoke to the Dallas Morning News.
I don't know what it's going to take to get our park back, to get our river back, to let our river heal. That is a destroyed island. It'll make a comeback if we just remove everything that's there. We got to let the river heal. We got to let our community heal. And we need to remove all these impediments out of the river. That's a federally protected river. None of that stuff should be there.
And this is the Mexican President AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, speaking last week, condemning Texas Governor Greg Abbott's immigration policy.
Their nationalities are being investigated. The people found at the Rio Grande River as of yesterday, and action is going to be taken. We already are demanding the removal of these buoys, which violate our sovereignty and our human rights. He, the Texas governor, Gregory Wayne Abbott, shouldn't act like that Texas migrant policy. It's inhumane. You don't treat any person like that. No one should be treated like that. That's not something good people do.
So what is happening on this front, Marissa Limon Garza? Is there any move to remove the razor wire? I know the federal government is saying they're taking action. What exactly are they doing?
The federal government has, through the Department of Justice, is seeking, you know, litigation against the Abbott administration to remove these barriers and to make sure that this is not happening here at the southern border. We here in El Paso know very well what kind of a scar militarization is on our regions, and that extends from San Diego all the way to Brownsville. This is a reality that we face every day when we see concertina wire at our ports of entry, we see border wall construction, steel bollard fencing, we see drones overhead, checkpoints out of the region. And it's no wonder that Eagle Pass is suffering these grave harms with this horrific new iteration of a way to increase militarization on pieces of land, environment that have been protected and have been really enjoyed by flora, fauna for millennia. And so to see these kinds of atrocities really flies in the face of everything that we believe in and value in. And so it's time for that federal government to take more of an active response, continue to push for more action to make sure this practice ends. And so there can be an attempt at healing, both from the environment as well as from communities. I know members of Congress will be visiting the southern border this week, and so we call on them to really take action and to push the administration forward on ending these horrific practices.
Now, your organization, along with 200 civil, human rights, and immigrant rights organizations, have written to the Biden administration, which has been using the decrease in migrant crossings between ports of entry as an example of the asylum policy working. What are you calling for in this letter?
We are calling for an end to these practices. We know that the decrease in numbers is not really an actual representation of what is happening, and it cannot be attributed to this new policy. We know that the policy, people take time to see what kind of impact it's going to have. And the reality is that people are continuing to be on the move. We're calling for an end to the use of all of these detractions that are getting in the way of people being able to seek protection and making sure that people have access to territory that they should be able to seek protection with them. We join many other organizations across the country in unison, really calling for an end to these practices, especially all of the things that are related to the circumvention of lawful pathways, the policy that the Biden administration has put into place, and really against the use of the credible fear interview and expedited removal that's caused incredible damage and an erosion of due process for anybody trying to seek protection while in the custody of border officials.
Finally, Marissa Limon Garza, the issue of the desperate heat and what migrants face, if not the razor wire, the deadly heat.
The heat is horrific. You know, today, yesterday in El Paso, I believe we reached up to 112 degrees. We've had the longest streak of over 100 degree temperatures in our region. And the reality is that migration doesn't stop. And so there are limited resources for people. It's caused grave harm and danger, ultimately resulting in death in many instances. And it's a reality of migration that shouldn't be part of what happens. A lot of the deterrence through cruelty practices push people to more dangerous and remote parts of our border. And that results in increased loss of life and damage and harm when it comes to heat-related illnesses and other problems. So it's another element that's only ratcheting up the other consequences that we have when it comes to these kinds of practices and these kind of deterrents.
And the issue of border guard not only not providing water, but sometimes taking water that humanitarians leave for people who might be seeking refuge.
Yes, I mean, it's devastating. There are calls throughout the community for people to be able, just regular folks, to be able to have access to water. We have cooling stations in our community intentionally so that people can cool off. And yet those kinds of protections don't extend, it seems, to migrants, which is inhumane and horrific. And so to hear that families intentionally, knowingly, are being left without any kind of water, a basic human right, is devastating. And so that's something that we're certainly against and in favor of a real humanitarian response, which is what the response to migration should be first and foremost, is recognizing that, that common humanity and what we all feel as we're going through this scorching summer as a result of the climate crisis.
Marissa Limon Garza, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center, speaking to us from El Paso, Texas. We now go from El Paso to here in New York City. Mayor Eric Adams has announced a plan to house as many as 2,000 asylum seekers at a tent complex on Randall's Island in the East River, as his administration claims the city surpassed its housing limit to shelter the tens of thousands of asylum seekers who've been sent to New York since last year, many by Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Newly arrived migrants have repeatedly been forced to sleep in the streets, including last week when dozens waited outside Manhattan's Roosevelt Hotel for days, sleeping shoulder to shoulder on the sidewalk in hopes for a bed and shelter. Others have been stuck in the city's shelter system for months as New York officials have failed to provide asylum seekers with permanent housing. Meanwhile, migrants who apply for asylum have to wait 150 days, 5 months, to file for a work permit, leaving them few options to make a stable living while they wait. For more, we're joined here in New York by Murad Awada, Executive Director of the New York Immigration Coalition and NYIC Action. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Murad. Talk about the situation today where the mayor, the Democratic mayor, Eric Adams, faces a deadline to tell the state, tell the New York governor what New York City needs.
Well, first, thank you for having me with you today. I think one piece of, information I'd love to share is that New York, New York City, New York State has welcomed immigrants and refugees for centuries. This time is no different. We have been welcoming folks from across the world. And this past year, we've seen an increase of folks coming from the southern border. And through that, we've also seen our systems not actually working here in the city. We're a city of 9 million people. We're a city that has long had an incredible impact across the spectrum of contributions from various communities, specifically within immigrant communities, helping build our skyscrapers, our bridges, and every piece of New York City and New York State has the immigrant imprint in it. Last week, what we saw on the news across the globe at this point is asylum seekers sleeping outside of the Roosevelt Hotel, which has been converted into an immigrant welcome center. And those images were gut-wrenching. How can we in a city of New York continue to have a broken system, actually broken shelter system that continues to have people dehumanized in this way? As well as last week, there was a court hearing where the city and Legal Aid, who's the monitor for the shelter system, went into court, and it was a closed door session, but pretty much it sounded like when they got out, the city needed to make its request to the state on what other supports that they needed for shelter, because in the state constitution, it also puts it on the state. But this doesn't erase the fact that we've been dealing with the increase of folks coming for a past year, and we've just been doubling and tripling down on broken policies and broken systems that don't work and never have worked. So for us, we've been asking for people to be supported to get out of shelter and into permanent housing, and that continues to be our top ask in this moment.
Mayor Adams has asked to suspend a decades-old right to shelter order that requires New York City to provide shelter to anyone who asks for it. Talk about the significance of this, Murad.
Right to shelter is actually a decades-old policy that actually allows for, regardless of who you are, to be able to get a shelter bed. Historically, there was a lot of tension within the services that were being provided decades ago, where single men were not allowed to get shelter. And the court found that that was inhumane and illegal. So since then, right to shelter has been the not just a court decree, but it's a law. We have numerous policies at the state level, at the local level, where we pretty much have codified in a number of different ways. It's a very complicated policy, but it's incredibly strong. So you can't just gut it because you don't want to fix the system that's broken. You have to actually fix it. And the best way of fixing it is actually cutting the red tape and the barriers from people who are unhoused being able to get the support that they need to get out of shelter and into permanent housing, which seems to be a big issue for this mayor who doesn't want to do that.
So Mayor Adams is actually saying he wants to send flyers to the U.S.-Mexico border telling asylum seekers not to come to New York. And then we know, of course, the governors are sending asylum seekers to New York. Some don't even know exactly what's happening or where they're going.
Yeah, I think that we need to really invest whatever resources we have right now into staffing up our city's workforce. And not these other stunts of like hiring outreach workers at the southern border to deter people from coming to New York, because New York has historically been seen as where you can achieve your American dream. And that's why many immigrants, including my family, have come to New York, and why the city and the state's population, over a quarter of the state's population, are immigrants. And that's why they continue to come to the state regardless of what folks are saying, because this is where, if you can make it in New York, you know, you can make it anywhere. And that's the dream that folks are trying to strive for. And in this situation, people just need a little bit of help. What we're seeing is that adult asylum seekers and migrants who are coming here are not actually staying in the system very long. They're staying about, on average, between 30 and 45 days. What we're seeing that's actually more distressing is the migrant families and recent arrival families that are actually going to be stuck in the shelter system even longer than historically unhoused families. And our historically unhoused families stay in this shelter system for years before they're ever offered any real support to get out into permanent housing. So we want to flip this on its head and actually support people to get out as quickly as possible.
Murata Wauda, where are the asylum seekers coming from? Not all are from Latin America, but within Latin America, where and where from elsewhere?
We're seeing a lot of folks. I think the vast majority of people who've come over the past year are Venezuelan. And what we've seen also with regard to Venezuela is that the government has collapsed in a number of different ways, right? And we in the U.S. are not seeing the highest migration of Venezuelans here. If you look around in surrounding countries, about 6 or 7 million Venezuelans left Venezuela, and the vast majority of them are in South and Central America as refugees in these in their neighboring countries. So we're just seeing a small population of Venezuelans coming up. And global there's an increase in global migration across the board. So this isn't unique to the U.S. This is happening everywhere. And we actually have to create policies that move us into being more welcoming and continuing to actually give people refuge and safety. But the vast majority of the asylum seekers are Latino, with a great deal of folks coming from Venezuela, some folks coming from Peru, Colombia, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Ecuador. But then we also have a large contingent of folks coming from Africa, right? We have folks coming from Senegal, Mali, Mauritania, Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo. We have folks coming from Haiti. We have folks coming from everywhere.
Which also, by the way, goes to issues beyond immigration. For example, when it comes to Venezuela, the strangling sanctions the U.S. has imposed against the Venezuelan government.
Yeah, or just foreign policy in general, and how our foreign policy is impacting our the migration movement on a global scale, right? It's not just what's happening there. It's also historically the U.S. interventionist policy in these other countries as well that has moved people to seek safety and refuge here.
And the climate crisis.
Absolutely.
So finally, are other cities looking to New York as an example of how to deal with asylum seekers?
I think that, unfortunately, right now, what we're seeing is that other cities are actually busing people to New York as well, instead of trying to find how they can support our new arrivals, right? But if folks want to come to New York, we're here to support them. I think that we have to, this is not just a New York issue. We're seeing folks coming from everywhere, going to different cities. So I think that there is a model here that we can be uplifting. And I think LA actually has the better model of how to support recent arrivals and ensuring that they're getting the support and housing as well as the services that they need, where it's a real partnership from every level of government down to the community-based organizations, really stepping up to actually meet the moment together.
Murata Wauda, thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the New York Immigration Coalition. Next up, Iraqi men suing the U.S. military contractor Khaki for torture they endured at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Stay with us.
Never seems to die. Trails spent with fear, not enough. Living on the outside. Never seem to get far enough. Staying in between the lines. Hold on what you can. Waiting for the end. Not knowing when. May the wind take your troubles away.
Windfall by Sunvolt. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a federal lawsuit brought by Iraqi torture survivors that appears to finally be heading to trial after a federal judge refused to dismiss the case. The Center for Constitutional Rights and four Iraqi men are suing the U.S. military contractor Khaki, which was hired to provide interrogation services at Abu Ghraib, the Iraqi prison where the men were tortured by U.S. guards. The lawsuit was first filed in 2008, 15 years ago. Since then, Kaki has attempted 18 times to have the case dismissed. This is one of the plaintiffs in the case, Salah Al-Ajaili, speaking on Democracy Now! Almost a decade ago, talking about what he endured at Abu Ghraib in November of 2003. He was working as a journalist for Al Jazeera, had traveled to Iraq's Diyala province to report on the U.S. invasion. It was there that U.S. soldiers detained him. He said when he asked what he was being taken in for, their response was, "You know the reason." He was ultimately transferred to Abu Ghraib. When I spoke to him a decade later, he was in Doha, Qatar. I asked him about his time in captivity.
يعني أنا طيلة فترة بقائي في الزنزانات الانفرادية كان هنالك تحقيق يجرى كل يوم.
Throughout my detainment in the solitary cells, there were an interrogation every two or three days. During these interrogations, we were subjected to many psychological and physical torture methods. One of these methods was that you were kept naked, handcuffed, the hood on your head. Then they would bring a big dog. You hear the panting and barking of the dog very close to your face. This is one of the methods of torture and interrogation that they conducted. There are many other similar cases.
How long were you held like this?
يعني قضايا التحقيق كانت التحقيق التي كانت تحدث كل يومين أو ثلاثة أيام يستمر التحقيق لساعة ساعة ونص.
These interrogations that happened every two or three days would last for an hour and a half or 2 hours in this manner. The details of the interrogations were different. In some cases they would bring dogs, then start the interrogation. In other cases they'd put you in a place and throw cold water or hot tea on you, then start the interrogation. But of course all the interrogations were conducted while you were kept naked and hooded, and they'd ask you questions to which you answer. I stayed for 40 days in a solitary cell, and 70% of that time I was kept naked.
That's Salah Hassan of Al Jazeera, also known as Salah Al-Ajaili. Well, for more, we're joined by Bahar Azmi. He is legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, representing the Abu Ghraib plaintiffs in the case. Bahar, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain the significance of the judge once again saying no, the lawsuit will not be thrown out, as Kaki has attempted 18 times to do it.
Thanks, Amy, for continuing to pay attention to this now epic struggle by our clients to get justice, some measure of justice. What the court held here and has held repeatedly is that the plaintiffs here, our clients, have presented sufficient evidence that they were subject to torture at Abu Ghraib and that there was a connection between the military police, some of which were featured on the pictures that we've all come to be horrified by. There was a connection between the military police and Kaki interrogators sent from headquarters in the United States, insofar as those interrogators, the Kaki interrogators, were ordering the military police, who were acting as guards, to, quote, soften up detainees in the night shift at Abu Ghraib, where there was, as military commanders found investigating the war crimes at Abu Ghraib, a command vacuum. So the court has found that there was sufficient evidence of torture, sufficient evidence connecting the torture to Kaki interrogators and domestic headquarters, and has cleared away any, I think, remaining obstacles to this case finally going to trial and our client speaking openly in court.
So talk about your client. Start with Salah, who we just saw, who we interviewed like 10 years ago. Where is he today? What happened to him and the others?
Yeah, so we represent, in this case, four detainees. We had prior cases representing nearly 200 individuals that was thrown out by a D.C. federal appellate panel, and in the majority it was Kavanaugh, and in dissent was Garland. We brought another case on behalf of 71 Iraqi citizens against a translation company. That's the Al-Qurashi case that settled favorably, and this case is on behalf of now three, regrettably one of the four plaintiffs was dismissed, individuals who were in the hard site at Abu Ghraib. This is against Kaki specifically. And all three plaintiffs were swept up in the chaos after the occupation, ultimately found their way to Abu Ghraib and suffered the range of tactics, interrogation tactics, and violence tactics that cumulatively amounted to torture. So sleep deprivation, forced nudity, sexual humiliation, temperature manipulation, and outright beatings. Saleh in particular has found his way to Sweden with his family, now has residence there. They're all suffering the after effects, psychological and physical, of their time in Abu Ghraib 20 years hence. But Saleh and the others are really seriously looking forward to appearing in a U.S. court and telling a jury and the American public about what happened to them.
Bahar, can you talk about the email sent by a khaki employee? The judge in the case, Lanny Brinkema, has said this could really be a smoking gun. The khaki employee, writing an email to his boss outlining what he'd witnessed, apparently resigning in protest, the judge said. Brinkema said she was amazed that no one at khaki seemed to follow up on the employee's concerns. Khaki lawyers have disputed that the email, which is not publicly available, is incriminating. Talk about what khaki is, how it was involved, and what their argument is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so khaki now, which is a huge, continues to have huge contracts with the United States government around surveillance and technology and border technology, at the time was hired to provide interrogation services under contract with the U.S. government and sent over highly unqualified but comparatively senior private contractors that took command of the military police and ordered these kinds of abuses to extract, to soften up the detainees and extract intelligence. So the question in recent years as a result of Supreme Court rulings is, to what extent is corporate domestic conduct related or perpetuating what happened abroad for purposes of, you know, this jurisdictional question. And Judge Brinkema in a prior hearing did single out an email going back and forth between on the ground in Abu Ghraib and headquarters, pointing out the seriousness of interrogator conduct there, sounding the alarm to headquarters, which we say the headquarters largely ignored and covered up and continue to deny to this day.
Bahar, I wanted to show an image, and for radio listeners, they can go to democracynow.org, of the plaintiff we heard, Saleh Hassan, hooded in Abu Ghraib with his vomit at his feet. Where did this photo come from?
This came from the discovery process in the case. There are not many photos that, you know, specifically identify our plaintiffs, but this is one of them. As you see, he's prostrate, suffering, hooded, bound in the humiliating physical and psychological set of techniques that were so prevalent in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And that he and the other plaintiffs had to endure.
Well, we were going to continue to follow this, as we have for these years, a case that is now moving forward after 15 years. Bahar Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, representing the Abu Ghraib plaintiffs in this case against khaki. For two decades, he's been part of a team challenging the U.S. government over the rights of Guantanamo prisoners, discriminatory policing practices, government surveillance, and the rights of asylum seekers and accountability for victims of torture, and representing these Abu Ghraib prisoners as well. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The art of the mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. Yeah.